Good afternoon. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, and welcome to the Walker Community Room at the Fayetteville Public Library. I'm Kyle Kellums, and on behalf of KUAF and all of Northwest and Western Arkansas, we're proud to welcome Paula and Tales from the South here for their first ever live radio broadcast. Support for KUAF comes from Dog Party USA, hosting its annual Dogs Night Out Saturday, September 7th at 6 p.m. This fundraiser is a progressive gourmet meal for the dogs and an evening in food and live music for their owners. Tickets available at the door, proceeds benefiting the Humane Society of the Ozarks. More information on Facebook or dogpartyusa.com. Now, what could be better than sitting down on a late summer Sunday afternoon, hearing some great stories from your backyard, and some great music as well? Ladies and gentlemen, the Fayetteville Public Library, the Fayetteville Roots Festival, and KUAF are proud to present Tales from the South.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but how's everybody doing today? All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are coming to you live on KUAF and on the road at the Fayetteville Public Library in beautiful Fayetteville, Arkansas, as part of the Fayetteville Roots Festival. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both in North Little Rock, Arkansas, and I'm your host, Paula Morrell. Tonight, we have two incredible musicians, Nashville-based Mary Gaucher and Austin-based Michael Fracasso, who will be playing for us between the stories on this very special first-ever live broadcast. What do y'all think about our set back here? Do y'all like our set? Each show, we feature an artist, and so our featured artist today is local artist Caitlin Cantell with these pieces back here, which are for sale. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and Caitlin at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Yeah. Today, our writers are all from the Fayetteville, Arkansas area and bring us tales of being under pressure. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later today, Mark Beasley has to think quick. And then M.B. McQueen hatches a plot of revenge. And we'll end the day with Vicki Taylor-Penny and flashing blue lights. But let's start the show with Beverly Belden Litzinger as she works up the nerve to knock on the door in Finding My Father at 50.
One sunny day, when I was 2 months shy of 50, I stood within the fenced yard of what I hoped was my birth father's home. I had never met this man whose name was on my birth certificate, but I had carried a single photograph of him my entire life. Trembling, I walked to the door and knocked. No response. I knocked louder. No response. So I knocked again. No response. I was so close, I just couldn't make my legs walk out of the fenced front yard. Just at that moment, the mailman stopped at the gate and handed me some mail. "Why did you give me this mail?" "Well, you're a relative here, aren't you?" "Why would you say that?" "'Cause you look just like the old guy that lives here." I looked at the mail. It was addressed to Ralph Belden. By the way, he's hard of hearing. I have to practically beat down the door when I have a delivery. So I marched right back up to that house and peered through the screen door. A wide porch separated it from the entry door. My knocks weren't being heard. So I spotted a piece of broken 2x4 in the yard with which I could just reach the side window. I banged on it with all my intensity. Now, I'd been told when my mother and father got married and headed for California on the train, he asked her how much money she had to go in on the trip. When she replied that she didn't have any money, he confessed he thought she was a little rich girl and he really didn't have any money either. They got off at the first stop. She took a job as a secretary and he as a shoe salesman until she discovered she was pregnant. Scared and realizing she hardly knew this man, her husband, she headed home to have that baby. He did not follow her, and I was brought up by my single mother in my grandparents' home until she did remarry later. I love the family I had, but I felt different from them. Earlier, it was just a feeling, but as I grew older, everyone could see physical differences. At age 12, I was 5'9" and wore a size 10 shoe. All the female relatives were 5'4" and wore size 5.5 shoes. To my mother's irritation, I wouldn't stop asking questions about my daddy. At one point, she yelled, "Go look in the mirror if you want to see your daddy." My grandmother took pity on me and showed me a single picture of Ralph Belden. I did look exactly like him. At that moment, I made a pact with myself. I would find him one day. When I was in college, a family friend sent an obituary of my father's mother. It listed one survivor, a son, Ralph, of California. Courage began to bubble inside of me. Armed with obituary information, I began a 30-year search by dialing every area code in California. When I married, I searched through the phone books in every city my husband and I visited. I searched the Mormon records. I wrote the state of California. I was optimistic about help from an FBI agent until he asked for a Social Security number. None of these efforts produced any results. Then, one day I received a card from the Halbert Company, a computer listing agency, asking if I wanted to know the names and addresses of all the Litzingers, my married name, in the United States. Well, no, but there was a name I wanted to know. So I just called the Halbert Company. "Do you have a listing of the Beldens?" $39.95, we can make you a book on any name, lady. My check went in the mail. When the Halbert's World Book of Beldens arrived, Ralph W. Belden was listed as living in Pomona, California. I sent a Christmas card, including a brief note explaining who I was and asking him to please reply. I heard nothing. I began to realize I might never find my father. In 1996, my husband's business required him to spend a year in California. When he came home at Christmas, after 6 months, I went back with him. On the drive from the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas, where we had lived for more than 20 years, my husband said some of the sweetest words he's ever said. "We're going right by Pomona. Let's see if your dad is there." So there I was, standing in his front yard, knowing my father was inside, that I looked just like him, that he was old and hard of hearing, and it was now or never. Finally, I heard a voice at the screen door. "Go away, we're sick in here." He had come out to the porch. Are you Ralph W. Belden?" "Yeah, but I don't know you." "Well, my name is Beverly Belden, and I have reason to believe you're my father." His response was not what I expected. "Never had a daughter." "Didn't you know my mother, Virginia Ray?" "Nope." "How about Ginger? She said you called her Ginger." "Okay, I know that woman. What of it?" "Well, I'm her daughter, and she told me you're my father. Never had a daughter." "How can you say that? Your name is on my birth certificate." "Where's your mother?" "Well, she died a few years ago." "She must have died awful young." "Well, yeah, she had a hard life raising a daughter alone." "Well, I wouldn't say anything bad about her if she's dead." "Look, I doubt you can say anything about her that I don't know." I couldn't imagine what he could possibly mean, so I waited for his reply. "Well, she turned up pregnant right after we married. So I never thought that baby was mine. I figured she played me for a sucker." Suddenly, my mother's reaction to the search became clear. He had said this to her, no doubt. And in 1946, years before DNA testing, she had no proof. But I had his picture. I knew the strong resemblance. The mailman had even confirmed the resemblance. But he couldn't see me through the blackened door. I want to see you. Will you open the door? Lady, I'm not dressed. Well, and we really are sick. Can you come back another day? No. And I don't care if you are buck naked. I only want to see your face and look you in the eye. I can't come back. I've waited to see you my entire life, and I am not going to leave until I look at you and see if you're the man in my picture. Well, you've got a lot of moxie. Where'd you get that? Your mother didn't have that kind of moxie. I don't know where I got my moxie, I said. You got any moxie? The door opened. I could see him now, and he was visibly shaken. I never thought you were my daughter. I moved in closer. What do you think now? Why, I can see myself in you. I guess I better think about it some more. Now you know why I wanted you to open the door. Please, could you come back another day? I really am sick. Yes, but I need a definite day, and I need your phone number. I'm only in California briefly. I live in Arkansas. Oh, yeah, and I don't want anything but information. I'm not here for back child support. We set a date. We exchanged phone numbers. Ralph called the day before our meeting to cancel. He was still too sick to get out. We rescheduled. The next time, his wife called to tell me that EMS had taken him to the hospital the night before. He had collapsed. I asked him if I could tell you to come, she said. He's weak, but he's agreed to see you. He's wondered a lot about you over the years, she said. I was there within an hour. As I entered the room, he said, I'm all yours. Ask me anything you want. I'm not going anywhere. We spent the day together, and I took notes on his life. I discovered we were a lot alike in more ways than looks. The end of the day, he patted me on the knee and said, you're a very nice person. I'm glad you finally found me. I spent a great deal of time with him before he died 2 years later. I asked him if he wanted us to take those DNA tests for proof. He said he really didn't need to take a test. He already knew. I know more now about who I am because I looked. I never gave up, and I found him. Oh, yeah, and I thank God every day the mailman showed up when he did.
Beverly Belden Litzinger is a storyteller, English teacher, and writer with two books in print, Talking to the Trees and Cooking 101, 22 Healthy Vegetable Dishes for Picky Kids. She lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas with husband W.C. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Mary Gaucher.
Steam Train Maury died last night. His wife Wanda by his side. He caught the westbound out of here. Hopped the high irons to the by and by. They say he jumped 1,000 trains. Rode 1,000,000 miles for free. Helped out at VA hospitals and penitentiaries. Dandy Dave and Rusty Nail, and Sweet Lady Sugarcane. Deadeye Kate and the Baloney Kid raise a cup tonight in old Steam Train's name. Senators and congressmen, puppets on a string. Among windswept vagabonds, Steam Train was the king, the last. Of the hobo kings. He was the last of the hobo kings. Wander around. Tramps dream and wander too. But a hobo was a pioneer who preferred to work for food. He knew how our nation was doing by the length of a sidewalk cigarette butt. Born with an aching wanderlust embedded in his gut. Hounded, beaten, laughed at, broke, chased out of every town. With his walking stick scepter, with his shredded coffee can crown, the last of the hobo kings. He was the last said, and he paid them cash. The stories he bought from them helped him to write The Grapes of Wrath. But boxcars have been sealed for years, and trespassers do time. Railroad yards are razor wired, and now hoboing's a crime. So here's to ya, Steam Train Maury. Hold that westbound tight as you ride off into history. The last hobo, the last ride, the last of the hobo kings. He was the last
Next, the pressure is on for Mark Beasley in More Ways Than One in Bad Mowers Make Good Neighbors.
My lawnmower was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The old mower was as dead as a doornail. But not to worry, my father had instilled in me a basic set of skills. These were not the skills of how to fix anything, rather the skills of how to find someone whose father-instilled skills were already honed, and badger and bother them to fix my stuff for cheap, free, or barter. Well, that's where Glenn comes in. Glenn was my across-the-street neighbor and known mower repair guy. He and his wife, Betty, were the first people I met when I moved across the universe from my old Razorback Stadium neighborhood to their Lake Fayetteville neighborhood. I'd asked if I could pay him to get the mower running, and he said that I could probably figure it out because there wasn't, quote, much to him. I explained my mechanical knowledge by telling him that someone once asked me for a Phillips head screwdriver, and I only half-jokingly replied, "Phillips head, is that straight line or Starboy?" I was pretty sure it was Starboy, but it didn't hurt to be up front. He grinned and offered help. We both knew our roles. His was to help out the whole hood by fixing the mower associated with the most unkempt yard on the block. And mine was to hand him things, stay out of the way, not hover, not ask too many questions, and refill his sweet tea or Coca-Cola. But that's where things stopped being sitcom-like. He said, "Mark, it wasn't right. I mean, yeah, my name is Mark. I mean, Glenn wasn't that old. But I knew instantly something was not right about the way it came out. Years ago, I had worked for the Hilton as head of security. In that Fayetteville Hilton training, they taught me to listen to that ambiguous inner alarm. There was even an initialism for it, JDFR, just doesn't feel right. If something just didn't feel right, you were not to ignore it. Well, this was a just didn't feel right moment in spades. I went over to him, hoping to be wrong about all this. He was down on one knee, kind of T-bowing before it was cool. Except this posturing was not celebratory. This was cause for possible concern. Glenn seemed concerned, too. He wanted to say something, but hesitated. After a too long and utterly nerve-wracking pause came, "I think I might need help getting over to the house." Without asking, I sort of lifted him to a standing position, and he allowed it. We turned slowly like the most unlikely waltz partners ever, and he took my arm and hand. This act alone caused the just doesn't feel right alarm to ring and gyrate like a cartoon telephone. Here was a member of what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation. They survived the Great Depression and a world war. They fixed their own mowers. They did not need to be escorted anywhere, and they didn't need to hold hands with other men for no good reason. We walked at a pace that you would take if your foot were severely asleep. We finally made it from backyard to front. Glenn had not spoke again, but now pointed to my 91 Nissan Sentra, indicating he needed to lean against it. The car was not parked in the garage, driveway, or even the street, but right in the front yard, as we native Arkansans are inexplicably wont to do. Convenient. At this point in the tale, I can practically hear you all screaming for me to call 911, but here's the thing. In that situation, where one barely knows the other party, where one desires to be respectful, where one is trying to get his mower fixed for free, one doesn't want to come right out and say, "Hey, you're even older than I. You having a heart attack, you rascal?" I got him to the car and I said, I'm going to grab my phone and call for some help. I'll be right back. Things shifted gears from that infinite stroll. I ran as fast as I could, jumped my four stairs to my front porch, tore open the storm door and ran inside. My nephew Ryan was living with me at the time, and his phone and my phone were both on the coffee table, thank God. I grabbed both phones. I dialed 911 with the first and my brother Max, a nurse practitioner, with the second. Ryan, get in here. I think Glenn is having a heart attack. I'm serious. 911, what is your emergency? Neighbor, heart attack. Ambulance to this address. Breathing? Yeah, for now. Age? I don't know, 70s? I hand the 911 call off to Ryan and I go back to check on Glenn. Looking out the front window on my way to the door, I see something disturbing. He has taken about three steps toward his house, but is now listing to one side like the Titanic. I am not going to be in time, but I have to try. I hit the door like a linebacker and jump the steps. We lock eyes, and I see pain, distress, and his awareness that he is falling. He hits the ground without bracing himself and makes no vocalization at impact. These two things drive me toward panic. With regard to all things medical, I know even less than what I know about screwdrivers. But I knew this. Glenn was dead. I don't say that to make it a better story or because I have any formal training in identifying death, but when he came to rest on the ground, his head was facing straight into the midday sun, and his eyes were wide open. I know that no one can look right into the sun like that. So Glenn was dead as a doornail. And now he had been dead for 1 second more. And now, 1 second more. Maybe it's the writer in me, but I actually saw a word in my brain. Think. The font was a beautiful copperplate Gothic bold, but and that's a sans serif. But anyway, the thing is, I needed to think, and think I did. CPR, now, but I don't know how. I didn't know CPR, but I'd seen my share of TV and started my version of it. I felt Ryan's presence by my side, and he did what I wanted him to do without me asking, which was to block the sun from Glenn's eyes. I don't know how long the compressions went on. Time gets weird in these moments. I don't know if my technique was good, but it was enthusiastic. After a while, I had a need to make contact. I yelled right into his face, Glenn, as if I could scold him back to life. From 1,000 leagues down and too immediate to be real, I thought I heard a faint, yeah. I was 5 years old fishing on the lake with grandma, and that tiny yeah was a tremor on my bobber. My grandmother was in my head directing me to reel him in, and don't lose him. Centimeters from his ear and louder this time, Glenn. Nothing. Nothing. And now 1 second more. Then another, yeah, came from Glenn. 10% stronger this time and almost annoyed. He moved and we could finally hear the distant sirens. He came around. Meanwhile, we never got through to my brother Max, but his El Salvadorian wife, Carolina, which is still helpful as she is an RN. She said to get him to swallow some aspirin. No Tylenol, no Advil, but old school aspirin. I didn't have any. You know who would? Glenn's wife, Betty. I ran as fast as I could to her door. I darted over there and knocked loudly. I told her Glenn had fainted and asked for some aspirin. You can call it lying. I'm an actor, so I call it theater. The EMTs arrived. As with the mower, I stayed out of the way but available. They took him. The last 10 minutes had been about 3 hours on the treadmill. It was my turn to spend some time with the ground. Then I realized I should drive Betty to the hospital, but she'd already gone. She came over that night when things were still uncertain. It was hard to look at her. She was forthright. "Mark, I've always said if I could be anything but a woman, I'd be an old mower." Strange. "And I want you to know that if things don't go right, he will have died doing what he loved." She was concerned about the guy who killed her husband. Wow. She called me a hero. Well, I'm not a hero, but I now get the whole reluctant hero thing. Glenn, turns out, was fine. Still is. But if he ever gets too uppity with me, I'll just paraphrase Bill Cosby and say, "Look, I brought you back in this world, and I'll take you back out again. I have other dead mowers." Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like for you to meet Betty and Glenn.
Mark Beasley is a writer, actor, and director of Arkansas Playwrights Workshop. He is currently writing a screenplay, Me and Lima Bean and Our Quest to Meet Billy Bob, for his production company, Club Swank Productions. Please help me welcome back Mary Gaucher for one more song.
What a wonderful, wonderful library this is. The best part of my childhood was libraries. They were my place of refuge. I used to spend days in the library and work my way through the books. When I got to the adult section, the librarians became concerned. This is one of the most beautiful libraries I've ever seen, and it's a thrill to be a part of this show. We're at the tail end of the Fayetteville Roots Festival, and what a weekend it has been. Thanks for including us. Sure could use a little mercy now. The fruits of his labor fall and rot slowly on the ground. His work is almost over. It won't be long, he won't. I love my father. He could use some mercy now. And my brother could use a little mercy now. He's a stranger to freedom, shackled to fear and doubt. The pain that he lives in, it's almost more than living will allow. I love my brother. Sink into a poison pit. It's gonna take the faithful. Follow them down. I love my church and country. They could use some mercy now. Every living thing could use a little mercy now. Only the hand of grace. Was another mushroom cloud. There's people in power who'll do anything to keep their crown. I love life, and life itself could use some mercy.
Next, M.B. McQueen takes the hit and then switches to offense in About Face.
My little brother, Sherwood, buzzed around me like a hyperactive fly. We were born a year apart, close enough in age to be allies, close enough in physical proximity to often want to pound each other into dust. He mocked my voice, stole my stuff, teased me unceasingly. "Mom, make him stop," I'd whine, but she'd just tell me to ignore him, the way she told me to ignore bees and bullies. It was like instructing me to ignore an annoying skin rash. I just couldn't do it, because neither a rash nor my brother's taunting would go away on its own. He complained about me and received the same answer, though I'm certain I was innocent of his accusations. It was obvious we'd have to fend for ourselves. In an expressive household, we would have just fought and been done with it, but our mother was as Southern as Cairo syrup and a believer in civility. There would be no hitting, kicking, pinching, or punching, ever, or else. Working within the confines of Mom's restrictions, we became trailblazers of creative vengeance. By the ages of 9 and 10, we developed ingenious methods of taking the other down. After one harrowing day of putting up with his nonsense, I dragged out the tape recorder. Sitting in my bedroom, I repeated, "Sherwood is a brat, 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 Sherwood is a brat," over and over and over again into the tiny microphone. Rewinding the tape, I cranked the volume and placed the recorder by his bedroom door. "Turn that thing off," Mom yelled and ordered me to set the table. I put the recorder away and went to the kitchen. Obediently, I arranged 4 decorative placemats, 4 identical plates, and a matching set of glasses for my parents, my sister, and me. My brother's place setting? It consisted of a mismatched mat, a slab of green Melmac, a tiny salad fork, and a plastic tumbler of water. No ice. It was a small difference, but it pushed him over the edge after the tape recording. And he cried at the dinner table. My parents looked at him as though he'd lost his marbles, but he knew what I'd done. The drawback to this sort of warfare was that Sherwood's tactics were always much more brutal and complex than mine. He'd lie in wait like a tiger, then spring when the time was right. I soon forgot those earlier incidents, and Sherwood seemed to have done the same. 2 days later, we sat in the living room watching The Little Rascals. During the commercial, Sherwood said, "You know, somebody told me something today." We were back in friend mode, hanging out and chatting. "Who? What?" "Bobby Harper," he said. "It was about you." My heart began to bunny hop. I had a huge crush on Bobby Harper. I'd written his name 500 times in my 3-ring binder. He was the nicest, cutest boy in our neighborhood, and he lived across the street. "What? What?" I pushed. "What did he say?" "Let me get a drink of water," Sherwood said, leaving me to die alone of curiosity. He returned with a tall glass, sat back down, and took a slow, dramatic swig. "What did Bobby say?" I was almost pleading. I was surprised he'd even conversed with Sherwood. Bobby was a few years older. He never bullied us like the other neighborhood kids did, because we were invisible to him, or so I'd thought. I had to know what that cutie had said. Sherwood took another long swallow, made an "ah" sound, and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "Well," he began, "he said he thinks you're really pretty." I should have known something was up right then, because in no way was I pretty. I hovered between cute and nondescript, with dark, messy hair, freckles, and dull hazel eyes. I'd recently developed a nervous habit of pulling out my eyelashes, so my eyes were completely bald. No, I was not pretty. Still, I wanted to believe. "He said the only reason he doesn't come over to talk to you is because he's afraid Dad would get mad." A red flag should have gone up on that one, too. At 10, I could have been dating an 80-year-old, and our father wouldn't have blinked unless the guy's car blocked his in our driveway. Still, what else? What else? "He said he loves you. Every night, he goes to his window and looks at our house, hoping he'll see you. And every night, he blows you a kiss." "You're full of it," I told him, narrowing my bald eyes. "He never said that." "Okay, don't believe me. I don't care. I just thought you'd want to know." That night, I crept into our darkened den in my plaid nightgown. Perched on back of the sofa, I peeked through a slit in the curtains and gazed at the house that contained my beloved Bobby. A light was on. I prayed I'd catch a glimpse of his silhouette through the shears, waited for his kiss to float to me on a breeze. Sadly, he never appeared. I saw him the next day, though, tossing a baseball in his yard with a friend. He didn't acknowledge me, but I wasn't surprised. He had to keep his love for me on the down low so as not to upset my parents. On the third night of my window vigil, Sherwood walked into the den in his little NFL pajamas. "Ha," he whispered and crowed at once. "You believed me. You fell for it. I knew you would." Disappointment fanned the embers of my humiliation, which sparked a blaze of fury. Too heartbroken to speak, I went back to bed. Lying there, my freckles drowning in tears of self-pity, I hatched a plan. Sherwood loved football. I don't mean love it like he does now in a semi-sane way. He worshipped it, the way drag queens worship Cher. His room was wallpapered with posters of Roger Staubach, O.J. Simpson, and Larry Zonka. At night, he snuggled beneath football player sheets in a bedspread printed with helmets and goalposts, his arm wrapped around a Wilson football. He stashed that football on the floor of his room in the small gap between his bed and the wall. Each night, he reached down, grabbed it, and hugged it like a teddy bear until he fell asleep. A few nights after the Bobby Harper incident, I carried out my scheme. While Sherwood took his bath, I crept into his bedroom, ninja-like, and wedged into the space between his bed and the wall. Cramming the football under the box springs, I lay down in its place. Then I waited, covering my mouth with one hand to keep from laughing. I felt deliciously evil. I stared at the poster on the wall above me. OJ looked happy in his uniform, as blissfully unaware of what the future held as my brother was. Just then, Sherwood burst into the room. The scent of Mr. Bubble filled the air. From my hiding place, I watched his bare feet travel the room. He stood his closet for a while, then moved to his dresser. He opened and closed one drawer, then another. Finally, he turned off the light and climbed into bed. The springs gave a squeak, then silent moments passed. My heart hammered. Then Sherwood reached down. In the dimness, I saw his hand hover, then felt it graze the carpet near my head. His fingers reached for his football, but instead of pigskin, he felt human flesh. Instead of neat rows of white laces, he touched a face. His fingers traveled a few more millimeters before it all sunk in. A nose, an eye, a cheek, a chin. His hand froze. I heard him inhale sharply. Ma. He tried to scream but couldn't. Terror caught in his throat and he could only croak out a whisper. I couldn't stand it any longer. Triumphantly, I emerged. Leaning against Sherwood's bedpost for support, I laughed so hard I had to cross my legs. My sides hurt, my cheeks ached. I gasped like a banked carp. Revenge was mine. Of course, the little weasel ran and tattled. Sherwood always seemed pretty advanced for his age until I stepped over the line, at which point he went crying to mommy like a sissy. I probably got spanked that night, but I truly don't remember. The sweetness of victory far exceeded the pain of any punishment I received. Best of all, I gained Sherwood's admiration. In proving myself a worthy opponent, I became a much cooler sister.
M.B. McQueen is a humorist, poet, songwriter, blogger, and self-published author. Her work has been featured in magazines and newspapers, though not nearly enough. Originally from Memphis, Tennessee, she now lives in the Ozarks. Ladies and gentlemen, y'all give up a warm welcome for Michael Fracasso.
Oh, I come from Henry for Elizabeth Lee. She was a black-haired beauty, made a fool of me. while I was breaking my back down at the Pittsburgh Steel. I turned a river of fire into an automobile. I said, don't worry now, baby, I'll buy the clothes you need. Oh man, she liked to party on my booze and weed. I go to work each morning, pack my lunch in a bag. I felt trouble was building, just like a mountain of slag.
In our final story of the day, Vicki Taylor Penny feels the pressure from the heat in Super Trooper.
The 6'3" Arkansas State Trooper in full regalia met me at the back of my car as I stood on the dirt shoulder of Highway 65. There wasn't another car in sight. License, please. There was no smile in his voice. I turned to my oversized purse I had tossed onto the trunk of my 1980 Mercury Lynx, and that's when I heard the snap as he unlocked the safety of his holster. Highway 65 between Pine Bluff and Grady was at the time a two-lane road snaking its way through the farmlands of the Arkansas Delta. During the day, the fields are filled with the activity of big agriculture, combines working the fields, collecting whatever crop was in season. At night, the road was a dark, desolate place with the occasional nightlight of a sharecropper's shack to break the monotony. It was a typical summer night in southeast Arkansas, hot, humid, sticky. At the time, I was 19, and whatever excuse I had for being out there on this night has long been forgotten. I think I'd been visiting friends, but in any case, I was headed home to Pine Bluff. My Mercury Lynx was my no-frills service vehicle of my undergrad years, a 5-speed with no air conditioning, unless you count the roll-down windows. More than just a few dings on the fender to give it a nice lived-in feel, and with plastic seats on nights like this one, ruffles weren't the only things with ridges. At least the car had a radio. In the mid-80s, the speed limit was 55, and just like the mantra of my generation, I can't drive 55. And it was a speed I frequently ignored. I had been cruising along, bugs splattering on my windshield, oblivious to anyone or anything watching me. Then I saw him, the car sitting stealthily in the darkness, lying in wait, the light blue stripe reflecting my headlights as I zipped past it. It was a state trooper. I quickly glanced at my speedometer, and to my total amazement, the needle was set firmly on 55 miles per hour. And as a bonus, I hadn't consumed any alcoholic beverages the entire night. I chuckled to myself and turned up the radio. Suddenly, I saw headlights in my rearview mirror. They were closing fast, and I thought to myself, the trooper's gonna have fun with this guy. It was about that time that the blue lights came on, complete with the flashing white lights in the grill, and the worst part, the officer was behind me. Oh, great. I was taught from the time I got my learner's permit what to do when pulled over. Number one, remain calm. Number two, stay in your car. And number three, follow all directions from the officer. So, of course, I slammed my car into a full stop on the side of the highway, jumped out, tossed my purse onto the trunk, and moved right for that officer's car. And that's when I heard a very stern voice in the darkness yell, "Halt! Walk back to your vehicle." Well, at least I remembered number three. And I quickly did as I was told and stood perfectly still in the stark, bright, flashing lights of the police car. I remember thinking to myself, this must be what a deer feels like after wandering onto a busy road. He strode out of the darkness and demanded my license. I turned to open my purse, and that's when I heard the click of his holster opening. I really couldn't blame him if y'all can remember the purses of the 1980s. You know, I could have hidden a shotgun in a family of four in mine. I lifted one arm where he could clearly see it and fumbled for my ID with the other. By this time, I was terrified, and I could tell he was a little bit more than suspicious. Finally, after what seemed like hours, I fished out my license. Without a word, he clipped it to his board and marched back to his car. I remained in the bright lights of his vehicle, struggling to determine why I was even in this predicament. I mean, he had asked me no questions other than for my license. After what seemed like a week, he emerged and handed me my ID and said, "Ma'am, I pulled you over because you have a headlight out." What? I could not believe this. He had put me through all of this because of a stupid headlight. I stepped back from my car and looked. Both lights were absolutely fine. How dare he? Here I was, standing on the side of this muggy, deserted road in the middle of nowhere, being harassed by a state trooper. I turned on him. "So, which one?" "Ma'am, those are your taillights." He never cracked a smile. I snatched my citation, turned on my heels, got in my car, and never looked back.
Do
Vicki Taylor Penny and her family reside in Northwest Arkansas, where she enjoys sharing stories with family and friends. So how about our stories and storytellers today? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience. Thank you to Mary Gaucher and Michael Fracasso. And thank you to KUAF for this incredible live broadcast. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
And quickly, I'll tell you, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, the Walker Community Room of the Fayetteville Public Library. Thank you so much, Public Library. Thank you, everyone connected to the Fayetteville Roots Festival. This has been a fantastic weekend. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Tell your friends. And should we do it again?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That's in the affirmative. Thanks for listening to KUAF.